Hi, everybody. We're back with The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited, and I'm Willie Romano Pugh.
Hello again. This is Jakob, and welcome back to a podcast about the hit HBO show The Wire, where we're going to be doing a deep read of season 3, Willie's favorite season.
It might be. I don't know. Like, season 3 is definitely the one that impacted me the most when I first watched it. But with like all the stuff that's happened throughout history since my first watch, I don't know. We'll see. It's all fantastic. It's all great. Just some housekeeping right off the bat before we get started. You've all been very wonderful to us in the past. We took a little break, but now we're back. But please remember us if you have any kindness in your hearts, if you want to donate to us at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Leave us a nice review. All that good stuff. You guys know what to do.
Yeah, exactly. We're really excited to be back here with you. Thanks, Willie, for laying it out.
Yeah.
For all. So,
but let's start getting into it. Season 3, we see the start of a new case that we saw germinate at the end of season 2, where the major crimes unit is going to go after Stringer Bell. We see some stuff going on in the political spectrum that we haven't really been privy to before. So, let's talk about, you know, the themes of reform that are introduced in this season.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the way, you know, season 3 came together, discussing politics, kind of an interesting little background story there, kind of a writer's meeting or retreat where a pretty prominent political, you know, journalist, veteran of the Baltimore Sun, happened to also be in town, I think outside of New York City, north of the city, Bill Zorzi Jr.
Yeah.
He's already appeared, that you pointed out so stupid in season 1, episode 3, and kind of became a huge, huge centerpiece, or providing a lot of the really authentic insight and background to this season. Drawing on his experience, because we know that the other creators and writers on the show are really into politics.
Yeah, Ed Burns and George Pelicanos joked around saying that the scene with Irvin Burrell and Tommy Carchetti in the diner after the city council meeting was all that they wanted to say about politics throughout the show. They were not really interested in whatsoever. So thank God we had some, you know, we have a chorus of voices to kind of chime in and build out this story of a city. We also have Richard Price, respected novelist who had wrote Clockers, which came out around the same time as Homicide, and who had a cameo in season 2 as the prison tutor or English teacher, I guess, joined the writing staff. Dennis Lehane, you know, he wrote Mystic River and all kinds of crime novels, just really broadening the scope, reinforcing the idea from the beginning that David Simon and Ed Burns wanted to have a novelistic approach to storytelling and television that was kind of unheard of at the time. So this is where it starts, broadening the horizons beyond a typical writer's room.
White guy dream team going on there. Unfortunately, no Walter Mosley. Didn't want to join.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But Bill Zorzi Jr., right? That's what we should call him.
Also co-wrote, or co-created, I should say, Show Me a Hero, further demonstrating his political know-how and whatnot.
It's funny you mention that. That's just where I was headed. I mean, could have been the back and forth we had about you rehashing and or watching the entirety of David Simon and Ed Burns projects in our break. Maybe, I don't know. Also, I was just going to say that David Simon apparently called up Bill Zorzi Jr. in 2001 and said, you have to read the book that Show Me a Hero, which was written in the 80s, right? It's based, like, Lisa Belkin, I think.
Right, yeah.
Obviously, my lack of words here shows how tuned in I am with Show Me Hero. It's been a while. I don't think I was gluten free when I was watching it, so I don't remember too much of it.
Well,
but my point being, Willie, I'm gonna get there. He said, Bill, you got to read this book, or, you know, I don't know if he was calling him Uncle Bill back then. He was assistant city desk editor, and he's at the Baltimore Sun. And then he totally forgot about it, got a call back 3 weeks later, and David Simon had asked him again. And he said he had forgotten about it, and, you know, he just forgot about it. And he said, you better effing read it, because, you know, we're going to be working on a project. And it kind of reminds me of having to continuously bother you about watching this documentary called Charm City throughout this entire time off. So,
hey, you know what? I finally
watched it.
I finally made good on it. And yeah, it was pretty great.
And it has to do with a lot of maybe current politics, which will tie in.
Right. Exactly. Another great thing about Show Me a Hero, or observation that I had, is that the way the story unfolds is almost kind of like a Tommy Carchetti storyline in reverse, because it's about mm-hmm. someone who was on the Yonkers City Council who got elected by kind of saying or advocating for some racist positions about public housing. And then once he actually got into the mayor's seat, he kind of got in touch with his conscience and realized the right thing to do was to advocate for low-income housing in these neighborhoods, and it kind of undid him. Whereas in, you know, spoiler ahead for future episodes in season 3, but Carchetti campaigns as a progressive who promises to lower crime in Baltimore and reallocate funding to schools and all this stuff, and then governs, you know, from a more corporate position or centric, like, you know, just kind of going back on a lot of his promises, which elevates him to the governor's office eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. And definitely not something we would then go on and see play out in real life, in the 2000s and so forth. But that's a whole nother conversation, or not.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll get into all.
But yeah, great points. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been good though. It's been good doing some R&D.
Yeah.
Is that a term? Research and development.
Yeah, that's it. That's a good job you did
that's
there.
That's it.
Good acronym. But
yeah, I've done even better job I did on all the you know, tech tutorials and so forth to improve the quality of our show here. Didn't spend time watching things like Boardwalk Empire. yeah, but even if I did, there's politics involved there. But let's just say it's good to get back to the wire, you know?
Yeah,
it's like
definitely.
No place like home in a way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you definitely know that. I definitely realized I was missing out on this when I was like, you know, I'm making my way through the whole Simon canon. And after I finished Generation Kill, I was like, oh, man, it's, you know, really great. But this is the most depressing thing I've ever seen. And then, you know, when I watch when I start watching season 3 of The Wire, I was like, okay, this is a little less depressing, and it's only an allegory for the Iraq War. It's not putting me in the actual position of people who are fighting it. So, yeah. Anyway,
it's all one war or another.
Exactly. As we figured out, and as many people have stated before, the opening scene of each season kind of lays bare the themes that are going to be explored throughout the season. And you have it right here. Mayor Clarence Royce is talking about how reform is not just a buzzword with his administration. And by, you know, imploding these project towers, they're going to make an effort to clean up the crime in the city and get rid of the drugs and all that and build new moderate to low income housing in its place. You know, this sounds like all good things, but there is a stark contrast with the dialogue that's going on with Poot and Bodhi, where Poot is talking about, you know, he has memories of these homes and he's going to be sad. And then Bodhi talks about how, like, this was just kind of a hub for him to catch venereal disease after venereal disease. And he keeps going into a clinic with his dick looking like a fried chicken wing, which is all very funny, but it also kind of, you know... gets to the larger metaphor of people, you know, who keep voting for the same politicians or keep doing the same things, but expecting different outcomes. And even, you know, in the short cold open with all the promise and big talk of, you know, a new day ahead, once they implode the towers, all the dust, debris and smoke just quickly makes its way out into the neighborhoods and causes people to choke and cough. You know, there's a lot of asthmatic people, as we learn in the city. So this is kind of only making the problem worse.
Like Bodhi says also, you know, people, they don't care about people. But Poot is, you know, he's going through it. But also interesting that once upon a time, it could have been said that by some that the building of these high-rise projects was also a type of reform as well. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because they were built largely to segregate the black populations that were inhabiting other areas, and then a part, you know, fell victim to slum clearance where they were essentially pushed into even more segregated high-rise projects like Lexington Terrace and the Murphy Homes. So but then on the other hand, they'd say, oh, well, look, you have now reliable electricity and heating and so forth. So it's kind of a reform. So I don't know if that ties in at all, because now they're being knocked down for more reform in some ways.
It's
really as it seems.
Right. It's very, very like fucked up, like circle of life, you know, everything. All the vacuums are going to be filled somewhere or another. With good and bad consequences or outcomes, which is kind of like a theme that runs prevalent throughout all of Simon and Burns's storytelling.
Mixed with mixed response. You know, a lot of people were excited in real Baltimore also to have a chance to become maybe homeowners in these new affordable non-high-rise units. So, but like you said, it's not a fine line. It's a lot of gray area.
It's cosmetic reform.
There you go.
And speaking of reform, another person that is trying to kind of embrace the idea of systemic change is Stringer Bell, who we have Stringer conducting a meeting with a lot of people. And we see him trying to rationalize an irrational industry with Adam Smith style capitalism. We see Shamrock reading Robert's Rules of Order, which is kind of like America's guide to parliamentary procedure in a lot of different settings. Yeah, we see him kind of trying to implement his ideas into the heads that we need to be smarter about this. We don't need to be so concerned with territory if our product is really good. And it's a little bit of a departure from things we've seen Stringer Bell talk about in the past, especially in season one when he tells D'Angelo people buy heroin no matter what, you know, even if it's stepped on or cut with other low-grade stuff.
And foreshadowing or taking into account that the loss of prime territory, which of course was Franklin Terrace, you know, will now result in maybe a power vacuum in some regards, even if Bodhi maybe was putting too much stock into the towers, with Stringer reminding him that they only really, you know, they were ceding territory to gain stronger product. So it might not be as detrimental as, you know, as it might seem. Also reminding Bodhi that what he had done previously as far as, you know, being a soldier and fighting over what he might consider Stringer might consider meaningless territory, resulting in innocent life being taken for no reason at all, really.
Right. I think, in all honesty, if this was a real situation, I would most likely be more like Poot, just making some asinine comment and having the leader smack the microphone off of the stand to chastise me. Pretty great comedic moment that we got there. I always love that scene.
Yeah, it's coming one day. One of us sooner or later is just gonna, you know, be so incensed by some like, as you mentioned, asinine comment and just smack our mic off of its mic stand. So, and you know, we have extremely official setups. I'm definitely not utilizing a TV dinner tray to anchor my mic.
I mean, yeah. Neither am I. Wink, wink.
All right. Yeah.
Well, we also have the first appearance of Marlo Stanfield, who shows up right as Johnny and Bubs kind of let their shopping cart full of metal go astray and hit a random SUV. He and some of Marlo's henchmen kind of point a gun at Johnny's face and threaten to kill him. We don't really understand the implications of Marlo Stanfield's position as of yet, but just the fact that he so callously tells them to go through with it or not because he has places to be kind of hints at the notion that there could be a power struggle coming up and that there might be like some sort of battle with a new, like, you know, an oncoming potential regime change with the old school and new school of drug dealers in certain territories of Baltimore, further illustrating like the allegorical Iraq war connections. But that I'm getting a little ahead of myself there.
Keep going. No,
that's all I got.
You can just tell, yeah, the old school and new school. Maybe we talked about that in the past, or David Simon and Ed Burns were into the kind of portraying that, where Stringer's talking about withholding from needless violence and Marlowe's just seems indifferent to potential, right, you know, bloodshed and a murder taking place right outside where he, you know, might be sleeping or where he's doing business. He's just like, sure, whatever, do it or don't, you know, I don't care. It's broad daylight. Who cares? So definitely right. Eerie.
And speaking of old school versus new school, we get taken back to Jessup, where we are first introduced to Cuddy, one of my favorite new characters, incredible journey that he takes through here and one of the rare like optimistic stories that's portrayed on this show. But we see him on one of his last days incarcerated talking to Avon and Weebe on the baseball field. By the way, Avon's little waltz through the baseball field where he just like makes everyone stop in their tracks and like completely halt the game because they have to respect that, you know, the boss is walking through, sends chills down my spine every time. Such a great like little moment to convey how still powerfully scary this guy is. You know, you have some interesting background here on historical context of the names that Weebe brings up.
They were maybe doubting, well, not Weebe, but was it Avon was doubting whether
he says the joint might have broken.
I don't know, there was a alleged dealer named Elijah Davis. I don't know, it's just probably coincidence, but yeah, he maybe had some cops on his payroll. One of them could have been Major Watkins, who was Roger Nolan from Homicide, which you're getting into.
Right.
His boss, who was like caught up in some corruption. So I don't, I might have more in further future episodes on Elijah Davis, but
all right.
Yeah. Who knows?
Cool.
They pull a lot of names, obviously. So sometimes though, it's not that simple as like the exact name, but yeah. Cuddy's not broken though, as we learn. He's just, you know, he's even kind of a little dismissive of the, you do 2 days. He's kind of looking at them like, I've been here 14 years.
So. Yeah, seriously. He shuts them down. He shuts talk of that down real quick because his delivery.
What are you talking about?
His delivery is so earnest and like impactful. Like he doesn't really have to say much to like get them caught in their own bullshit. saying, but
exactly,
you know,
I'm glad. A lot of things I forget about the show, but that was definitely refreshing, because every time I'd hear them say that, I just think, wow, 2 days, really? That's okay.
So anyway, once he gets back into society, into normal life, he feels like a stranger in his own town. He sees boarded up row houses everywhere. The package that he gets connected with via Avon's crew, he has a hard time with it and encounters some real problems with like the new school way of doing things when he encounters a character named Fruit.
I mean, I know neither of us would ever be in the situation. I mean, you never know, but like, probably not going to become a drug dealer, you know, at this stage of my life. But, you know, if you were in that situation, would you essentially, Fruit is set up like on the corner across the street from his Meemaw's house. So would you just like put more drugs right into your own street? You know, well, there were some street corners like Poppleton and Fayette, which like the Fayette strip is, you know, something that's mentioned where, you know, they're expanding their territory, or that's where the major conflict's going to transpire in this season, it seems. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. It seemed like he was walking, but I know maybe Cuddy, I mean, he's really fit, so maybe he just walks pretty fast, you know. There's a store in the area around his house, or maybe this is different, but that store isn't anywhere near Poppleton and Fayette, so I don't know if that was, you know. I know I've been a little harsh sometimes on the shooting locations, not really taking into account that, you know, okay, yeah, they're filming multiple scenes. They don't necessarily need to drive across the entire city to just film one corner, you know, of a drug deal or something. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's it's a pretty bizarre take. I'm trying to, you know, maybe ruffle up here. But yeah, to your point, you know, Fruit's just a real jerk and acts super brand new and
threatens
to basically, I mean, it seems, unfortunately, you know, getting a gun pulled out on you in that area is not necessarily a rarity, especially if, you know, drugs are involved. But, you know, he threatens to kill him more or less.
Right.
Cuddy's been around the block, literally, figuratively, whatever. He, you know, he still seems a bit shaken, especially because the code is completely different, like you said.
Yeah,
there's no number, there's no case number or whatever he had asked for, almost as a receipt of the GPAC getting taken by the cops, as Fruit claims. So he knows he's dealing with an entirely different generation,
culture shock. But as we as we see throughout this season, Cuddy is the one example where it's like a silver lining, where the reform is actually going to work out in his favor, because he goes through a process of personal reform where he learns how to channel certain passions into something positive. So it's a really great storyline to connect with. And it's good to latch onto something like that.
I don't know if this will be a proper transition, but
go for it.
As Cuddy is, you know, backing out of the alley where he gets the gun pulled on him, doesn't Colvin essentially pass by in that moment?
Exactly.
There's kind of a interweaving of the plot lines we got going on, and he embodies that, you know, at least the attempt to make a change in a system that he sees as you know, a dead end.
He's kind of like cruising around the neighborhood where he happens to see Cuddy walk by, and we're kind of like really in his mindset where he's just looking at the streets he's patrolled and worked for years and years, and sees that things haven't really gone anywhere in a positive direction. And he's feeling kind of disillusioned and depressed with it all.
I don't want to keep doing the, well, I'd never be in this position, but just for the sake of the art, I guess. I mean, driving around your own district as a major, how anxiety inducing would that be, thinking that, you know, Man, I'm going to see something crazy potentially. I don't want to necessarily get involved at this hour of the night, but I guess that's just what he needed to do. Granted, it was wrapping up things that he had observed throughout, this episode, as far as the work of his DEU units led by Carver and Herc, which we kind of see at the beginning of the episode as well. Complete overreaction to chasing down some hoppers who pretty much outsmart them from the jump.
And we also saw this in Bunny's brief cameo appearance in season 2, where he's just kind of lamenting the fact that, like, okay, we're gonna patrol this area for a while because a kid was killed here and things are gonna go quiet for a little while, but then what, like, things are just gonna return to normal and it's just gonna keep going on and on like this. And we see the power vacuum that was created at the end of season 1 easily be filled up so many times over. So he's like, at the end of his career, he's kind of grappling with like an existential crisis on like, what can he do to make a lasting impact and potentially like curb some of the endless violence that he's seen throughout his career.
Talking about maybe witnessing violence or the aftermath, as reform-minded as Bunny is and as, likable a character he is, and Robert Wisdom being a fantastic actor, one who even provided you with the epic cameo shout out on your birthday.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
Is he already kind of glossing over police brutality that that kid suffered at the hands of Herc and Carver? I mean, they're even admitting that they beat him down the Western District way. And I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but I can't remember. I mean, we're obviously rewatching this for a reason, but I don't, does his future action to kind of cast a wide net of reform maybe, make up for not taking this instance into account and following up on an obvious infraction by his police unit?
That's a really good point. I hadn't given as much thought to that as you had, but I think it's important to note that like he does recognize that it's a problem and he's concerned with them kind of going overkill on that thing, but he's so ingrained in the culture by then that he doesn't really know, he doesn't recognize that action needs to be taken, or it would seem like out of character or uncouth to like take action on that. Because I know later on, like down the line, when Carver is given a bit more authority and he takes disciplinary action towards Colicchio, that it's like a huge big to do within the department. So we kind of see the ramifications of disciplinary action even when it's totally warranted. So
yeah, and different times, obviously.
Right.
Almost 20 years ago, pretty much, you run from the cops, you're going to get beaten up regardless. Was still,
sadly,
the culture, and still happens, obviously. But maybe a change coming. We'll talk more about, some of the ways Baltimore might be reforming its police oversight and so forth. Yeah. Bunny's attitude. Kind of getting set up for the Comstat, saying obviously crime is, a huge issue. Like I said, we're going to talk about Burrell Conchetti here, but he asked Rawls, how can we hide the bodies? And Valchek, of all people's like, wow, that's a good burn. Told him, what got into you, man? Like, hey, and he says, what can they do to me? I'm 6 months from Major's pension. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, we'll find out what they can do to him. People, Rawls and Burrell are kind of hammering their message home more thoroughly once Burrell talks with the mayor and is basically pressured into massaging or juking the statistics into bringing the homicide rate by the end of the year to 275 to keep it. And that's like, they want to keep it as low as 275. So they're basically kind of trying to get the different majors to kind of be dishonest about their own police work and just get some good news on paper so that they will have to avoid any trouble from a lot of political higher ups, which in turn kind of like sets up Bunny's whole crisis with trying to figure out how to actually make a difference instead of just having a good feel-good story, a feel-good story on paper.
I'm not necessarily opposed to watching the cops sweat, you know, once in a while. So, well, I mean, you talked about the conflict Major Colvin foresees or is, you know, dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and another familiar face on the law enforcement side of things. Daniel's kind of caught up in a political maneuvering or something that you want to hash that out.
That's it. Involving his frayed relationship with his wife. He was basically led to believe that he would have kind of like a quid pro quo thing going on with Commissioner Burrell, that he could potentially get promoted to being major. Burrell said that he holds up his end of the bargain and kind of sends his name along to Mayor Royce, but it's all thrown into doubt when the news comes out that his estranged wife is running against an incumbent council member named Unetta Perkins, who's a favorite of Mayor Royce. And to Daniels's credit, he doesn't pressure Marla into backing off or anything. He kind of recognizes that he has to pay his dues to Marla and keep up appearances that they're still a happily married couple and that he's helping her on the campaign trail out of respect for all the work that she did for him to kind of support him in his career, even though she kind of left him out in the cold when they had lots of success in the last season with getting a whole new unit formed from the Sobotka case. So, I mean, she's kind of fucked up too.
They got their issues. I mean, he may or may not be living out of his office.
Right.
And catching naps on really small couches. Or
and he's a tall guy, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That didn't seem comfortable. Also, I know you had mentioned some pretty neat stuff about the incumbent that she'll be challenging, Marla. That is Unetta Perkins.
Well, David Simon and Nina Kostroff Noble mentioned in their great commentary that it was almost kind of an inside joke that she's an absent council member who doesn't show up for meetings, just because we barely see her throughout the show until, I guess, the last episode of the season. So their subtle way of reinforcing that idea of ineffective politicians.
They give, let's just say they also give opportunities to politicians that they may find ineffective, but people like O'Malley don't always take the invitation.
Yeah. They offered him a cameo.
They offered it, right? Yeah. Speaking of O'Malley, you know, he is kind of the, I mean, not kind of, he definitely is the inspiration for one of our main characters this season, Tommy Carchetti.
Carchetti's a composite of a bunch of different characters.
Yes, but definitely, you know, Simon did have some things to say about O'Malley. We'll get into all that, of course. So, yeah, you think it's cool to move on to talking some Burrell Carchetti? They meet at Werner's, which is a popular cafe. Unfortunately for, like you said, Pelicanos, you know, there's much more from the political side of things to be said. I mean, thankful that they went past just this meeting, because, you know, there's really definitely some magic that comes from all the interactions we get to see at City Hall. But just kind of a preliminary lunch meeting where Councilman Carchetti is attempting to maybe be a little chummy with Burrell. Burrell epically trying to deflect from the whole crime situation, stating that it's the schools, the tax base is leaving. Carchetti's really concerned they're losing, 12,000 a year in population moving to the county. So that's bad news, especially, you know, the way the city and county is set up and kind of a unique relationship there in Baltimore, which we talked about a bit previously, but hard to recoup those lost taxes, and especially in a struggling city. But of course, crime is the main reason that right. he says everyone's getting out. Like we talked about Comstat and so forth. So
right.
But Burrell is, he's been around, and he's no Jimmy, right? He knows the chain of command.
He knows the chain of command. It's a very unfortunate theme that gets brought back from season one, where we see kind of like the ineffectiveness of nepotism reigning supreme, with people kind of currying favor with each other to get into bigger positions of power. But Carchetti is not naive or ignorant, and he kind of has his own shrewd strategic ways of getting what he wants. So after this meeting, which ends really abruptly, but, you know, kind of amicably, you know, Burrell kind of gives him a lecture on the importance of chain of command. But if that scene were to end there, we would probably assume like, oh, you know, it's tough luck. I didn't get exactly what I wanted out of this, to try and get like a, if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours type of relationship with Burrell. But it ended, you know, amicably enough. But the next time we see Burrell and Rawls going into city chambers for the quarterly budget review, of course Carchetti pulls out all the stops and gets the media to bring all the cameras to place widespread attention on a lot of the budgetary discrepancies and just crime that's running rampant throughout the city. So he's not going down without a fight, and we're gonna see him in his epic battle throughout the season to try and place a magnifying glass on a lot of the city's problems.
Yeah, Carchetti calling to reallocate the police funds.
Yeah, even back in 2004.
Defunding or reallocating the funds from Florida trips.
Yeah, what can the Baltimore Police Department learn about policing at South Beach?
Talking about services, he does mention a story about the Fighting First District, and thought it was pretty interesting to mention the councilman that he's referencing.
Please.
I'm pretty sure that's what he mentioned. I mean, but basically Dominic DiPietro, or DiPietro, I think as they called him in Baltimore, who was known, his nickname was Mimi, and he was a real city councilman, served in the first district in East Baltimore, known as the unofficial mayor of Highland Town for 25 years, so I think 1966 to 91. And that's a real story. Apparently, he did grab Jimmy Carter by the backs, like his pants seat, or I don't know what the old school term would be, when he got invited to the White House to visit, to meet the Pope. So he went with the mayor, William Donald Schaefer, who pretty much was the mayor for the decades of the 70s and 80s until, you know, Kurt Schmoke, or before that, Clarence Burns, who you reminded me technically wasn't elected as the first black mayor, but took over after Schaefer became governor. But yeah, Mimi DiPietro is quite the character. So he saw himself as more of a populist, because he, you know, he just get things done no matter what it took for his constituents. So he took this cleaning his alleys out really seriously, enough to potentially assault the president.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that Carchetti alludes to him calling him a SOB, but I guess he just grabbed him or pushed past Secret Service to get to the Jimmy Carter. So, but I mean, I don't know what the beef was all about, because pretty much everyone in his district voted for, you know, Jimmy Carter. It's not like he hated the guy. I mean, he was a Democrat through and through, apparently. So it's not like he liked Reagan, but right. Yeah.
We're dropped right in the middle of that conversation. Oh, there's too much.
No idea what's going on.
Too much politics for me. I hope that scene in the diner is like the only scene about politics for the rest of the show.
Yeah, it basically is. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just like the first episode of each season, foray of characters kind of can be overwhelming. So
right.
If you're out there, you know, stick with this. I know we got a lot going on circulating here. You know, we'll hit our stride, just as the wire does.
Right. And speaking of an overabundance of characters, do we ever see or hear from Drac again?
No, I have no clue.
I mean, it kind of almost like speaks to the writing of the show that like so kind of switching gears here for a second, we're kind of like placed in the MCU shoes where they're kind of like trying to get Cheese's voice on tape and trying to get to Stringer Bell by somehow getting through to Prop Joe, and they know Drac is Prop Joe's nephew on his mom's side, which is apparently like a bigger deal than if it was on his dad's side. And it kind of like speaks to the whole prowess of the writing staff that we're placed in the same kind of boat that they are, where we're also like confused, like, wait, who is this person and how do they have connections to that? We also don't hear Cheese's voice throughout this whole episode, and we don't see Proposition Joe throughout this whole episode. So we're kind of firmly in their heads with how frustrating this all can be. And that kind of speaks to David Simon and Nina K. Noble, because this was the first episode they had to do without Bob Colesbury's guidance to kind of stick with the cinematic template that had been laid out so thoroughly in the first two seasons.
Yeah, that's something I was going to also mention. We didn't at the top of the show, you know, this is the first episode, or yeah, like you said, without Bob Colesbury, so tragically passed away in February of 2004, so not long before they started shooting, right? So and a lot of emotions, I imagine they spread some of his ashes on set prior to starting filming. So, but I think more importantly, just an overarching theme or a plot point, or I know I got to get better at refining my film terminology or my, you know, thematic language here, but you know, he's close to getting promoted, or if they're banking on the wrong guy, Drac, obviously incompetent as he is, being promoted, which is not something that, correct me if I'm wrong, Burrell is necessarily keen on, or, you know, but then it's of course noted that the wrong person often gets promoted in the police department, so forth, and, you know, reflecting on city government. So, you know, it's kind of maybe not the best plan of action, but that's what they got at the moment, and they're up on his phone. So that's a big step. But yeah, he's dealing with Lavelle Mann, so that's another character that's kind of thrown in there. But yeah, Lavelle Mann, a little more prudent, but Sidner, you know, he busts them doing his undercover stuff. I mean, this guy is just, you know, he's all over the place as far as the undercover work. He's a brave guy, pretty confident.
Well, we see him that he's learned a lot from Bubbles' dressing down in the first season.
He learned from the right person as opposed to Herc's ridiculous white guy undercover get up. So.
Right.
Yeah, so Jimmy's burnt out like usual, and he's pretty upset also on the fact that they let the last case get away, as far as Stringer still being on the street and Avon's on, you know, the path to release. And then he makes a statement stating that if you don't look back on what you've done, more or less, you're just going to do the same thing over and over, which I thought also might tie into the theme of reform. And,
exactly.
You know, some obviously things that Colvin is cued in on. Also, Jimmy, no regard for any sort of filing. Like, you know, someone might have, you know, hey, I don't want to reveal too personally what I do, but, you know, I spend some time filing in my life. So it's like, hey, someone worked hard on that, potentially alphabetizing and all that.
That was like
dumps everything on the table.
That was like a visual nails on the chalkboard for you.
Yeah, I was like, man, okay, whatever. It's your investigation. That's your, if you want to throw your baby around, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe not. That's not a good analogy, but what else? What else we got going on here? How we doing? You know, we're going to be wrapping up here, but
yeah. Well, actually, can I share a quote that I found from Homicide?
Homicide quotes. The book.
Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets by David Simon. He wrote that before he was involved in the TV industry whatsoever, but specifically relates to Herc using the Shaft theme in his CD player to kind of get amped for a lot of these drug busts. I should have mentioned it before, but that has kind of a real life connection to this cop named Terrence Patrick McLarney that's written extensively about in the book Homicide. So I'm just going to share a quote with you all that kind of illustrates the mentality behind playing the music from Shaft while doing police work. So Terrence Patrick McLarney recognized his obsession years ago, the day he was working a Central District radio car and drew a bank alarm at Utah and North. Was there any greater feeling than racing up Pennsylvania Avenue with that blue strobe light show on top of the car and the theme from Shaft blasting from a tape player on the front seat? Was there a bigger kick than charging past stunned patrons into the bank lobby, a 26-year-old centurion living by the big stick and the .38 bouncing around on his belt? Never mind that the alarm was sounded in error. It was the sheer spectacle of the thing. In a world of gray, weightless equivocation, McLarney was a good man in a city besieged by bad men. What other job could offer anything as pure as that? So just further proof that they take real things from history and their own observation and keep recycling it and reforming it and re-sculpting it into different ways to fit the narrative of the show. So I thought that was a pretty interesting little detail. And thanks.
I'm sure he was proud that it had landed on Herc's shoulders to embody that centurion spirit. Yeah, old McLarney. Any thoughts in conclusion here? I know, we're getting back into the swing of it. So,
I mean, time after time, the title of the episode says it all. They're just going to, time after time, we're going to get screwed over by the same policies that we keep tacitly unknowingly endorsing. So we'll see how that plays out and how people are going to get punished for actually trying to change things for the better. I'm excited to talk more about it.
Exactly. I am as well.
Thank you for sticking around with us. We know this might be a little shorter, but hopefully we kept things succinct. We're trying to condense things a little bit. We know we might have tried some of your patience with some of those 2-hour-long episodes. We're trying to get to the real juice, the real meat of the analyses and whatnot. So we don't put you to sleep. We're trying to keep things lively. Anyway. I think that's a good place to end, right? You think we could do our little signature awkward send off here, there, buddy?
Yeah, I'll do my best. definitely excited to do that awkward send off. More good content to come, of course. Not awkward content, of course.
Exactly.
It's gonna be fun. You know, it's just the beginning of another journey through Baltimore.
All right. Thank you for that. Be sure to subscribe to us on any platform of your choosing. Oh, we're on Stitcher now, in case anybody we're up on the Stitcher podcast platform. Really exciting. If you want to check that out, subscribe to us. We're on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at The Gods Will Not Save You. What else you got for us, Jakob?
Shoot us an email if you'd like, even thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. Interested to hear your opinions and so forth. And Yeah, you want to give some shout outs to our guys?
Yeah, let's shout out Andre Tesnes, who did our incredible podcast logo. What a great guy, what a great logo.
I agree, times two. Meaning, you know, I can raise the stakes there, and also I agree with both of those statements. That's what that can mean, right? We did say awkward send off, right?
Gotta stick to our word with that. Yeah,
shouts out to Mostart, always coming through with the music, original music. Check him out, mostart.com. More of his catalog, you won't be disappointed.
We'll see you next week for episode 2.